You're just in time. Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, Bill Harlan from ERI is here. We're going to see a lot of great pictures and even some drone footage of antennas in action and under test, and get to learn a little bit about how FM antennas work and what's important when selecting one. It's all coming up next on TWRT. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, savings, and support, online at bgs.cc. By Angry Audio. Audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. By Nautel, keeping you connected with your community with support and webinars, online at nautel.com/webinars. And by MaxConnect Wireless, prioritized high-speed internet service designed for transmitter sites and remote broadcasts. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about everything from the light bulb to the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower. And this week, we're going to talk about stuff that is really close to that light bulb at the top of the tower. You'll see what I mean in just a minute, because Bill Harlan of ERI is our guest. We're going to be talking about FM antennas, the technology behind getting the most FM signal out to your listeners. And it is fascinating because there's so many sciences that go into the design, creation, fabrication, and installation and utilization of FM antennas. I can't wait. Hi, I'm Kirk Harnack. I'm in the Telos Alliance studio in Nashville, Tennessee. Got lots of Telos Alliance gear all around me, and really appreciate my friends at Telos saying, hey, you can have an hour off on Thursdays and do This Week in Radio Tech. And that's just a real blessing. So glad to have that done. Enough about me. Let's check in with my co-host, the ever popular, patriotic, awesome dude known as Chris Tobin. Hey, Chris, welcome in.
Hello, Kirk. Thank you very much. I know we're talking antennas. Behind me is an FM combiner system from another company, but I figure what the heck, it would be fun sitting in front of FM combiners while we're talking about FM antenna technology.
And let's see, you're in, well, one of your secret locations that you often come to us from, right?
Yes, this is a Shively combiner behind me.
Yeah.
Balanced hybrid combiner. I make sure that I read the label correctly. Yes, that's it, yeah. I know somebody will yell. I'll get a call from one of the guys at Shively going, you said it wrong.
You seem to hang out there a lot. Is there like a coffee bar up there? What's the attraction? Oh, it's lots of bent metal, right?
Lots of bent metal, as you can see. There's an angle here. There's an angle there. There's an angle here. There's a lot of angles in this room.
I hear you. All right. Well, and tell you what, let's go ahead and introduce our guest, although we do have an announcement to make from Nautel coming up in just a second. I want to not delay at all and bring in Bill Harlan. A lot of you know Bill. You've talked to him on the phone. You've gotten proposals from him, not the marriage kind, but the antenna kind. Bill, welcome into the show. I'm so delighted you're here.
Oh, and I'm so glad to be here. Yeah, this has been really great. We haven't been on the show in a long time.
We did a little interview, I think, at a NAB convention where you explained a few things. We're going to do some big explanations. We got lots of pictures to share and even some drone video of some ERI FM antennas. And I can't wait. I've got a whole page of questions from our pre-show discussion that we're going to be talking about. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you in part by our friends at Nautel. And Chris and I, as usual, we have a pronouncement for you about Nautel and their Transmission Talk Tuesdays. They're roundtable discussions. They're not webinars. They're roundtable discussions. And that means you get to participate with these discussions. The topics coming up in October, they're continuing these through October now. Topics coming up: winterizing, HD costs, cloud-based everything, and I don't know if I can read this, stuff that went boom. And if you know Jeff Welton, he says he uses the word boom a lot. That went boom. This went boom. That's all coming up. You can register to jump into this roundtable discussion this coming Tuesday, but you can register right now at nautel.com/webinars for Transmission Talk Tuesday, nautel.com/webinars. Now, this coming Tuesday, the discussion is going to center around war stories. We've done war stories here on our show, and it's a favorite of Chris's and mine to do these war stories. But the discussion this Tuesday is going to center around the worst we've ever seen. So
and things that can be done to make the best of bad situations. I can't wait for Jeff Welton to talk about this, along with a lot of you and a lot of me and from the audience participating. What can be done to reduce the chance of issues arising from poor, or let's say suboptimal, installations? Things we can do to decrease the risk of failure without burning it all down and starting from scratch. Jeff Welton would love to hear from you on this topic and is going to open the floor to your input and questions. And if I can possibly be there, I will. I've made most of them, at least for a few minutes. And I'm eager to hear other people's war stories. The worst you've ever seen coming up this Transmission Talk Tuesday. So go register. You can open a browser window right now and go register at nautel.com/webinars. And you'll get an invite to come on into the webinar. You get the link. And I shouldn't call it a webinar. It's a roundtable discussion. Thanks a lot to Nautel for letting us talk about your Transmission Talk Tuesday. All right, Chris and Bill. Bill, I almost don't know where to start, because this topic of FM antennas to me is absolutely fascinating. It's a lot of black magic in some ways. And yet I do know enough about what's going on to, you know, be able to, let's say, cogitate on and understand a lot of what you're about to tell us, but I kind of need it all put together. Like, I got most of the puzzle pieces, but they're not all assembled into the final puzzle. So, Bill, maybe you can start out by telling us a little bit about ERI and, you know, the early days of ERI in the 1940s, and how you guys got to Chandler, Indiana, where you are now. What's the story of ERI?
Well, the company was founded in 1943. Tom Silliman, our CEO and owner's dad, Robert Silliman, was a broadcast consultant throughout the 50s. But during World War II, he worked for Andy Alford at the Radio Research Lab at Harvard. And they were doing research in radar, instrument landing systems, radio location systems. And one of the big things they worked on was chafe to jam radar. And the problem with having the radio research lab at Harvard is you were right next to Boston Harbor. And so the German submarines would come in and keep an eye on what kind of field work the radio research lab was doing. And so one of the guys who worked at the radio research lab was from Evansville, Indiana, and he suggested that he move back to Evansville and open a company. And he did. And that's Electronics Research. And so for the balance of the war, they did all of their research here, because you can't get a German submarine to go up the Ohio River. And then after the war was over, Tom Silliman, or Robert Silliman, returned to his practice in Washington, D.C., and he worked with Electronics Research to develop the 37 ring antenna for Collins Radio for their new FM antenna or FM transmitter business. And he got the design done and passed that over to ERI, and they were manufacturing it for Collins. And then a few years after that, Collins called Robert Silliman one day and asked him to come to Evansville and find out why the antennas they were working, or they were getting from ERI, were no longer working. And when he got here, what he found was that the founder and the technical resource behind the company had passed away, and the accountant and the widow were trying to run the company. And so Robert Silliman bought 50% of the company in one share, and the other portion of the company went to two key employees, and ERI reopened and primarily focused on the FM antenna business. And since then, we expanded. We were down by the airport in Evansville, and then we moved into downtown Newburgh. And in 1992, we moved to the 100-acre campus we're on today. And in 2003, we acquired Andrew's broadcast equipment business and moved that down here. And so we're doing not only FM antennas, but transmission line filters and television antennas all on this campus.
Wow, that is a lot. And what a way to grow. So we've got a lot of pictures to share, and the pictures will bring up, you know, the things that we want to talk about. So a lot of this show is going to be looking at pictures of antennas and test procedures and things like that, so that there'll be, you know, natural things to talk about. Yeah, Bill.
No, I'm just saying, yes, I'm ready.
Okay. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, people my age, or maybe a bit younger, most of what we know about ERI is the famous rototiller design. And we're certainly going to be looking at some of those and talking about how that works. But Bill, before we jump into some of the pictures, I found out from you today, and I should have known this, is I've bought other antennas from ERI, but you guys make plenty of other FM designs other than the famous rototiller. Just cover the couple or three models, model series aside from the rototiller design.
Well, the rototiller, of course, we have a low and a medium power version of the rototiller, and they're used for single channel applications for the most part. But we also have special versions, which can operate with two, three or more FM channels in a single antenna. We have a version of the rototiller, which we call the Axiom, which is an actual true master FM antenna that's a side mount antenna. And of course, we have our 1180 and 1190 series panel antennas, which are used for either single or multi-station antennas, either directional or non-directional. The 1080 and 1180 series is probably best known because there are three of them on the Empire State Building. The 100A is a low-power translator antenna that we've produced for about 10 years. And the 1105 is an improved version of what used to be the cycloid and dual cycloid ring stub antenna that really was the first circular polarized antenna that ERI manufactured.
Gotcha. And I like learning about FM antennas from that ring stub design, because that's almost easy to visualize what's going on there, but we might get some input from you. Let's go ahead and Suncast, if we could start with the pictures. Reverse. Oh, here we go. Great. Bill, take it away. Tell us, what are we looking at right here?
Well, this particular antenna, this is the University of South Florida's FM station and FM antenna in Riverview, Florida. That's on a 1,000-foot tower we put up 2 years before the repack started. So I think it was 2014 or 2015. The 8-bay is on top with a lambda section. As you can see, it tapers from the 57-inch base tower. That little platform you see on the side there is a transition platform to get out from the inside ladder to the outside ladder to get to the antenna. And the tower to the right is what they call the PBS tower. It's got WEDU TV on top and what used to be WUSF TV on the bottom. That was their digital antenna, or tower and antennas that they built as part of the transition. And WUSF was one of those stations that was purchased by the FCC during the repack auction. And so the spectrum could be repurposed, and they're in a channel sharing arrangement with WEDU now on RF channel 13.
So this antenna in the middle of the picture here, that 8-bay, that's the rototiller. Is that the high power version of that?
It's a high power full wave spaced rototiller for it's a class Z0 FM WUSF.
Being full space, those are approximately 10 feet apart. Is that right?
They're at a non-commercial frequency, so below 90 megahertz. So they're on the order of 130 inches apart.
Okay. 11 feet or so. All right. Now we're going to, not right now, but later on, we're going to talk about that lambda section. You use that word lambda, and I'd like to make sure I have a good understanding of what that means. So let's, Suncast, if we could go ahead and look at the next picture here. We're going to buzz through about three of these pretty quickly. Oh my goodness. What are we looking at here, Bill?
Well, this tower is actually just a few miles south of the Riverview site. This is owned by Beasley in Tampa. It's down by the water. The antenna on top's WPBB. It's a half wave spaced 8-bay on a lambda. And if you look closely there, you can see near the top, the lambda is actually oriented independently of the base tower.
Wow.
And so, so that's freestanding on top. And then below that is a directional LP series rototiller for a translator that's rebroadcasting an HD2 signal for Beasley's WYUU.
So I've never seen a top tower section. I've seen lambda section. Never seen one that was of a different orientation than the main tower. Why was that done here?
Because the best pattern for the coverage area they wanted That's in a wetland area where they've only got limited places where they can put the guy anchors for the base tower. And so what they needed to do to give them the face mounting they wanted on that Lambda was they needed to orient the Lambda section in a completely different direction. So that means two things. You need an index plate, and it needs to be freestanding.
Now, it's maybe freestanding, but it's not what you might call freewheeling. They can't turn that at will, right?
Okay. No, they can't turn it at will, and it's very important that we put the holes in the right place when we build it.
I guess so. Well, tell you what. Right now may be a good time before our first commercial break here. Tell me about the Lambda section. What's key about that? I always thought a Lambda section was typically smaller, but that Lambda section looked pretty big, pretty big fat face on it. What's a Lambda section all about?
A Lambda is something ERI developed back in the late 80s, early 90s. The problem with putting an FM antenna on a standard tower section, standard tower sections are going to be 20 or 30 feet long. And what happens is, because the beta bay spacing on an FM antenna varies with frequency, and it's 10 feet at 98 megahertz, it's a different beta bay spacing at every other frequency. So if you just put that on a standard 20-foot section, then the cross bracing, the diagonals, the horizontal girts behind each bay of the antenna are different, and they're going to impact the horizontal and vertical plane pattern differently. So what the Lambda is the Lambda is a proprietary, trademarked, optimized FM mounting system, which is built in half-wave increments based on the bay-to-bay spacing of the FM antenna it supports. And that means that every bay sees the same structural geometry behind it all the way up and down the tower. And what that means is, if I take a two-bay rototiller and I model it, and when we do these range measurements, we actually range measure them on a section of the Lambda we are building to hold that antenna. We put that on the range. We measure two bays of a 12-bay array. Then we know that when we stack all 12 of those bays, they will all act the same way as the two we measured.
Wow. Okay. I was under the mistaken impression that a Lambda section was more or less invisible to the RF. It's not invisible. It's predictable. You know how it reacts with the antenna that's mounted on it, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
All right.
And the other thing.
Invisible would be kind of cool. Go ahead.
Invisible would be great. But the problem with invisible is you do that with fiberglass. And the problem is you do need a path to ground or something will blow up. Yeah. The other thing with an Lambda is, when antennas break, it is usually because the tower that's supporting it is not stiff enough. So when we design the Lambda, it's got a 3,000-foot radius of curvature for the antenna it's supporting. So it's a very rigid structure, and that protects the antenna over its lifespan.
So you're saying that one reason antennas break is because the towers holding them can wiggle in the wind and so forth, and that flexes all the joints on the antenna.
Yes, and it's even more critical in a pole.
I have seen that happen. I've seen antennas fail that way, and I thought it was maybe perhaps of poor mounting practice, but they may be mounted properly and still break because they're not mounted to a rigid enough piece of tower. Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. So you should ask about the radius and curvature of your structure.
Wow. All right, Bill, we're with Bill Harlan from ERI. Well, a lot more to go, a lot more pictures and some video, some drone video coming up. Chris Tobin, I'm finding this absolutely fascinating because I don't get a chance to ask these kind of questions ever. And Chris, of course, I need to make sure you feel welcome to jump right in and ask a question if we're not answering what you want to hear. What do you think so far, Chris?
Oh, I think it's perfect. It's great. Some of the things I've read about and learned and talked to folks over the years, but I have to say, my personal experience with ERI antennas over my 30-plus year career has been very predictable. One thing I always tell people when working on broadcast equipment is, reliability, predictability, and, longevity. And that's the one thing I can say about the ERI antennas I've been exposed to. And it's unbelievable. I have to find a way to make time to come down to the plant, of course, through invitation, and just get a chance to really look at how this stuff goes, because antenna design, I do a lot of land mobile radio stuff, microwave linking, and we do some wacky antenna positioning and propagation concepts and break the rules a lot. But to be able to design predictably and every time is just, that is an art in itself, and I really applaud what you guys do.
Well, I think we're going to learn a lot more coming up here as we move on through. And remember, ERI makes, you know, TV antennas too, and just, oh, it's amazing what they do. We got pictures of the range that Bill Harlan mentioned. That'll be coming up a bit later in the show. It's episode 511 of This Week in Radio Tech with Kirk and Chris and Bill Harlan from ERI. We're brought to you in part by our friends at Angry Audio. They are, even though they're angry, they're friends. And this is their famous. I mean, people are loving this. I'm hearing more and more people are using this, especially for broadcasting from home. It is the Bluetooth audio gadget from Angry Audio. You know what? This thing costs a lot less than you might anticipate. You know, custom made or designed for broadcast gear sometimes is kind of spendy. Well, not the Bluetooth audio gadget. Check it out. You pair it with your phone and it automatically, depending on what the phone wants to do, it automatically decides, am I going to do a two-way conversation and use one audio profile, or am I going to use a one-way audio path from your audio source plugged into the Bluetooth audio gadget to the phone, like, for example, for sending audio, or am I going to receive audio from the phone via Bluetooth and put that, let's say, send it to the audio console? Either way, this unit decides what you're doing and gives you the best audio for each application. It does that automatically. That's part of Bluetooth, but it's got to be properly implemented in order to work right. Well, the Bluetooth audio gadget is truly professional. On the back, you're going to find an analog audio input, left and right analog outputs, and you'll find a digital output as well. That's AES3, AES-EBU. So that is it just works amazingly well. I have talked to people who say, hey, I needed a phone hybrid and I didn't have a phone line. All I had was my cell phone. And yet I want to do high quality, or as best as I can, quality audio from callers. And the Bluetooth audio gadget will absolutely get that done for you. Moreover, let's say you've got some songs on your phone that you've recorded. Maybe you've got a file you downloaded. You just need to get that audio played from your phone into your audio console. You can do it with this right here. Hey, you know what? I'm just putting this out there. You could have an emergency studio transmitter link using the Bluetooth audio gadget. Plug the output of this into your FM processor at your transmitter site. Use your phone. Okay, you better plug it into a power supply. Use your phone to pick up your station's stream and put it into here and get your station back on the air if all else fails. How about that? An emergency STL, the Bluetooth audio gadget. And, you know, in the past, maybe you've had trouble with Bluetooth. That's kind of a thing of the past. This uses the latest Bluetooth technology to pair with the latest Bluetooth standards in your phone to give you really good audio quality. Again, I've talked to a number of people who say they love it. Well, you can get the Bluetooth audio gadget from your favorite equipment dealer. Just make sure that they carry Angry Audio stuff. And if you want to find out more about it, go to the Angry Audio website at angryaudio.com. I really appreciate Angry Audio for sponsoring the show. And you're going to appreciate all the cool stuff you'll find there, including Studio Hub. Studio Hub gear is all available at the angryaudio.com website. Thanks a lot for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. And hey, engineers, I really appreciate if you will patronize our advertisers and let them know that you heard about it right here. It really does help us out. All right, we're talking to Bill Harlan. I'm Kirk Harnack along with Chris Tobin. And Bill, I guess, why don't we jump right back into photos if you don't mind. Suncast, I know I'm asking you to spin the dials pretty quickly, but oh, well, here we go. What are we looking at here, Bill? Another rototiller?
Yes, this is a low power rototiller it's a 4-bay end fed, and that's also on a lambda mounting section that's at the top of a 400-foot self-supporting tower we built for Sarkis Tarzian in Fort Wayne. Put that this tower up, I believe, in about 2004 at a new location for their cluster there. You can see the anti-rotation brackets there.
Yeah, so now I got several questions. Okay, so the extra horizontal poles that go from the leftmost leg on the picture to the mounting bracket, those are anti-rotation? Is that what you called them?
They're anti-rotation brackets because the legwork that's supporting the antenna is less than 2 inches in diameter. So there's not enough area there for the bracket to grab to make sure it doesn't spin.
Okay. Now, does that one look half or full wave spaced or something else?
It's full wave spaced.
Okay. All right. From the sign, you know, from the ground, it's a little hard to tell sometimes. And this one is end fed. When do you decide if an antenna is going to be end fed or center fed?
Oh, that's a really good question and a really easy question. An end fed antenna, the more bays you add to the end of the array, the more difficult it is to get to tune. So generally, we try and limit end fed arrays to 5 bays or less. Beyond that, we center feed. Also, in an FM antenna, unlike a TV antenna where you've got slots up and down an outer conductor, and you can move the slots up and down the outer conductor as you wish and couple them independently. An FM antenna is series fed and generally has even amounts of power applied to each bay. And in a center fed array, if you want to add beam tilt or null fill, doing that in an end fed array is difficult. It's easy to do in a center fed array because you either, in the case of null fill, you change the power division so it's not even half up, half down. You put more power on the lower half of the antenna. And in the case of beam tilt, you move the center feed up or down to tilt the beam as you wish. It's a very simple and inexpensive way to do it. And that's because with a TV antenna, when you're charging $200,000 for a top-mounted antenna, you can spend a little more time on the little details of that versus what we sell an FM antenna for.
If I could ask Suncast to show us that same picture again, I've got one more question, the same picture we were looking at, and that is about the little star-shaped objects at the very top. Tell me what we're looking at there.
Those are ERI lightning spurs. That's a feature that's included with every one of our antennas and also with our top-mounted TV antennas. It's a galvanized steel rod, and then at the top you've got a set of bent stainless steel pieces which create a kind of a metal flower, if you will, that dissipates energy. The idea behind a lightning rod is you're supposed to be dissipating any static buildup into the atmosphere. It's not there to try and get lightning to strike it. The benefit of the little flowers there is, one, it gives you multiple points, and two, over time, as they get eaten with static, you can replace them without having to replace the whole rod.
Ah, okay. Okay. Got you. Occasionally I fly a drone and I get some really good pictures of those. So thanks a lot. If we could look at the next picture here pretty quickly, we'll see what's next. Oh, this is the range pictures. Okay. Talk to me about the range and how you make that work.
All right. This is a 50 acre test range we've got. It's about 5 miles from the main plant. And this is one of two turntables we have out at that facility. On this particular facility, the equipment shack is actually the basement underneath that turntable. This is a 2-bay half-wave spaced LPX, and they're in the first stages of developing that as a directional FM antenna. In our test range, the antenna under test is the source antenna. And you see there on the right, that's a monopole that we've got mounted there. And it's got two basket receive antennas, one horizontally polarized and one vertically polarized. And that actually measures the signal as the antenna is rotated on that platform below.
Okay, so let me get this straight. So I just noticed in the picture I started looking for when you mentioned it, over in the far right, upper right-hand corner, there is a monopole at the end of that mowed grass area. So I'm sorry, is that one receiving or transmitting?
That's receiving, and that's got data cables that come back to the equipment shed, which is the basement of that structure, and that records what the measured pattern is.
So how would you choose in your test range if you're antenna under test is actually transmitting or is actually receiving? Because you could do it either way, couldn't you?
You can do it either way, and the results are the same. That just happens to be how we set the range up.
Okay, okay. it's so cool that, well, when you turn that thing, does it turn 360 degrees or more than 360? Does it spin continuously? And if so, how would you couple the power to it? Or, you know, what's the arrangement of the bottom there where you're coupling the antenna into the equipment that's measuring?
It turns around and then turns back. So you're turning 360 degrees and then turning back.
And is it just cables flexing underneath, or is there some cool contraption?
Just, it's just a cable flexing underneath. There's nothing really magic about it. The positioner itself is actually the real magic.
The positioner. So I guess you've got to know precisely how it's positioned, don't you?
Yes, and you've got to get that back. And today we don't write any of this stuff down. In the old days, they used to move the turntable by hand and write it down every 2 degrees.
Right. Okay. Now, that next question, how many degrees is acceptable for measurement? Or what do you guys do better than acceptable?
We generally just measure each degree.
Each degree. Okay. Let's take a look at the next picture. I think we had a couple of range pictures here. I'm not sure. Let's see what Suncast pops up next. Oh, yeah. Now, this is a different site.
This is just the other turntable we have out at that site. Again, this is a two bay rototiller under test. We've had both these turntables out here for quite some time, but this particular one with the building behind it is actually, we spent a lot of time making sure there wasn't any metal in that building. There is no plumbing and piping. You've got to walk over to the machine shed if you have a need. The largest of our two turntables. We can actually put a 10-foot face tower on the top of that and spin it, or a 12-foot. It's a pretty substantial piece of equipment.
Now, the antenna, the tower section we're looking at there, is that a lambda section? Is that particular one, or is it just an ordinary tower section?
It's just a regular tower section. We have a whole boneyard, which you can probably see over there in the upper left-hand corner.
Oh, yeah.
We can pretty well put together any kind of model that's required. Again, as I said earlier, if it's a lambda section, we actually do the testing on the lambda that will hold the antenna.
Of course, yeah, yeah. What's the next picture we have here, Suncast? A drone view of the facility. What are we looking at here?
Yeah, this is we do have a separate machine shop out there, and there are some equipment sheds, and just wanted to show some of the different, the large number of structures we have laying around to turn into whatever we need them to be.
Gotcha. In talking about pattern testing an antenna, in many cases, it's absolutely required. Like if you have a directional antenna, right? You have to have this pattern.
If you have a full service facility, yes. And if you are using the directional antenna to protect in another FM station, you have to use either full scale or fractional scale models on a accurate representation of the structure, and have that as a proof of performance to get your license. If you're a secondary facility like an FM translator or an LPFM, assuming LPFMs get allowed to go directional, you are allowed to just use a computer model, because as a secondary service, if you cause interference, you've got to turn off the air.
Ah, okay. So I've been in situations several times where I'm working for a relatively small, low-budget station. The pattern of the antenna is not extremely critical. In other words, we're not trying to make sure we get as much power somewhere, or try to get maximum circularity in the pattern. What, in your mind, what's a tipping point between no pattern, no range testing, and range testing?
It's really a revenue-driven requirement. I mean, if the results are critical, and you're talking about six-digit monthly revenues, then it's probably well worth the investment. And while fractional scale modeling is perfectly legal and perfectly acceptable to the commission, the problem is if you're going to do things at third or quarter scale, when you're talking about scaling something up, like or scaling something down, like a 10-foot face tower structure, into an accurate model 1/4 the size, and the same going for the radiating element you're using, it's very difficult to replicate that precisely at the smaller scale. And then if you're adding parasitics and directors, or changing bracket angles, scaling that back up and creating an accurate recreation of that at full scale is a very difficult thing to do. When you do things at full scale, it's much easier to know what you're measuring and then make it again, make it accurately to ship to the field.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Hey, let's buzz through a few more pictures before we have to take our next break. Suncast, let's take a look at this next one and have Bill tell us about this particular installation. What are we looking at here?
Oh, that one's not too far from you. That's in Crawfordsville, Arkansas. That's the center tower of a three-tower AM array. It's a DA2 AM990. So that's in a wetland area. The platform there at the bottom is a 25-foot tall platform we built. Then on top of that is a series-fed AM radiator that's a 181-degree tower for the 990. And iHeart has an FM antenna at the very top of that tower for KIYS. So that's a 101.9, or I'm sorry, it's a KWNW now, KISS FM. And that's at the base there. It's a series-fed antenna, so there's also an ERI isocoupler at the base of the tower.
Yeah, we have some close-ups of the isocoupler. Let's switch to the next picture and have a look at that. That isocoupler. Wow.
Yeah, that's a model 425. Yeah, it's quite the manly structure. You've got the I-beam base there of the tower, and it's sitting on the base insulator, and then the 425's on a post that's on the platform.
So for those unfamiliar, the isocoupler, that big can that's horizontal, you do a better job. Tell us what that does. Why is it necessary in this installation?
All right. You've got a series-fed AM tower, and this is part of a directional array. It's a DA2. This taller center tower is used both day and night. And you've got that whole hunk of steel sitting on an insulator because that's the driven part of the antenna, and then the ground system is the ground plane. And so if you were to just run that piece of coax with the FM signal on it across that base insulator, you would, in essence, be grounding this hot AM tower. And so what's inside that big barrel there is a pair of tuned elements that actually couple the power for the FM across the base insulator and leave an air gap. So there's a hot side and a cold side. So there's actually a fiberglass insulator on the right-hand side of that. So that part of the transmission line run is at the same potential as the AM tower. And then
we can switch
coming
to the
out
next,
the other side.
We switch to the next picture, but before we do, there's I saw the Austin Ring transformer there also, which was awfully cool. Suncast, go to whichever. There you go. The X, kind of an X-like looking thing at the left-hand side of the base of the tower looks like Austin Ring transformer. So that gets AC power for the tower lights across that base insulator. And it's one ring inside the other. You know, a good puzzle at Cracker Barrel is how do you get these rings apart? And it's a transformer. Yeah. It's an AC power transformer. So that whole tower on top of the insulator is indeed insulated from anything below it. Of course, it's fed with the hot AM power as part of the directional array. But I just thought that Austin ring there was pretty cool. You don't see those terribly often anymore. But the next picture, we get a better view of your isocoupler. And you said part of that was actually insulated. Where's the insulator at exactly?
It's actually, if you see that elbow, the elbow on the right-hand side there is actually bolted right to there. There's that whole face there is fiberglass, and there's something inside there. There are a pair of, we also have a pair of rings in there that create an air gap, but they are tuned to pass the FM power across that insulator.
So all the power, or almost all the power of the FM station that goes through there, it indeed goes through. There's very little loss in this situation. About how much loss would there be through an isocoupler?
Less than 0.05 dB. They're not a big loss thing. The biggest thing with isolation transformers is leakage. And so you've got to be it's a good idea to, it's something that you should sweep every once in a while, because a lot of these, you'll see the big box type FM isolation transformers where basically they've used some kind of insulator to make one half of the box hot and the other half of the box is cold. Those are outside. They generally, if they're not pressurized, they can leak. And you start leaking not only air, you start leaking RF. So we end up selling a lot of FM isolation transformers simply because they find high RFR levels.
Ah, okay. All right. Hey, coming up, you're watching This Week in Radio Tech with Bill Harlan, Kirk Harnack, and Chris Tobin is along. He's up in a bunch of RF himself. Chris, I'm finding this just fascinating. And, you know, I don't know. I think only one of my radio stations that I have actually has an isocoupler. It's for a low power FM translator to cross a hot AM insulator. I haven't seen one of those high power isocouplers in a long time. Do you run across those, Chris, in any of your stations?
My stations, no. I mean, I haven't done AMs in a couple of years, but throughout my career, I did AM FM combos, and we had high power, low power, and the barrel type canister ERI isocouplers I have used on many occasions on my ERI antennas on an AM tower. And we also had the Austin rings. So, yeah, it was always fun explaining to people what that's all about. It's great because everything Bill's talking about is stuff that I cannot fathom why some people just don't find it fascinating. It's just, you know, I know there's very few books on it nowadays. I do have some old NAB handbooks that are written in 1950s that do reference a few of the things that Bill has talked about. And they even show pictures of turntables for antennas in general. But it's a fascinating part of our industry that I think is really a lost art. I mean, there are a couple of guys that come here to this site. This is an FM site that's got backup stations. I'm primary with two others that are primary, but this is a backup site for the others here in New York. And the guys that come up, there's a few of them that have been here for a long time in the market. And when we get talking and some of the stuff we talk about, it's like it's foreign to the young kids. I'll call it that, the young ones. To the point where they panic. The look on their face like, what? You could do what with that? How much power? It's like, yeah. Meanwhile, the two or three of us are going, yeah, we've done it all the time. And yeah, you get a few sparks. Watch out for that. But you'll be okay.
No. Chris, coming
up. Experienced it. Yeah. You know, until you experience it, it's amazing.
Coming up, Chris, after this break, we're going to be looking at an antenna that is on the Empire State Building. Now, we're not going to look at it on ESB, but we're going to look at it at ERI. So that is coming up. Bill has provided some very cool pictures, and I can't wait to get an explanation of exactly what it is and how it works. And, Chris, I think you're going to recognize it because you've seen it many times. It's This Week in Radio Tech, episode 511, with Kirk Harnack and Chris Tobin. Our guest is Bill Harlan from ERI. By the way, there's a lot of educational papers and stuff at ERI. It's ERI, Inc., ERI-INC. .com is the website. A lot of resources there. We'll put those in the show notes. Hey, our show is brought to you in part by Broadcasters General Store, and BGS is your place to get anything you want. But one of the great things you can get, because it's a great little field utility mixer, if you just need what it does it really well. And that is the Broadcast Tools Pro Mix 4. The Pro Mix 4, hey, I told you it'll solve your problem if this is what you need. It's a mono mixer. It's a four-channel mono mixer with a USB interface. And that means it can be perfect for your COVID social distancing studio at home. Let's say that you've got a couple of people at home that need to be on the air. You get socially distanced in the house, or maybe you're in the same family, husband and wife team, and you get on the microphone inputs there. You connect the USB connection to your computer and you send your mixed audio to the studio. And the studio sends you a mix minus back of all the things that aren't you. It's a perfect, perfect solution for the home studio. Even if you're by yourself, it lets you insert audio from your computer so you can play out audio from the computer and put that on the air. It's just a really cool little full-featured little audio mixing console. It has features like three universal mic or monaural line input level input channels. It has a one mono balanced line level input as well. Plus, it has a balanced mono program output with a defeatable soft clipper. So, hey, if you get excited and yell, make sure that soft clipper's in. That way you won't clip the audio going to whatever you're feeding. It's got a built-in USB connection for computer audio playback and recording. It has a mix minus output if you need that. It has an LED audio output level VU meter. That's important because, you know, we can get pretty loud and forget about watching our levels. Well, that meter really stands out. Full duplex talkback capability and an IFB audio input with level adjustment. Plus, built in, it's got those quarter-inch stereo headphone outputs with independent volume, IFB pan, and program pan controls for a custom headphone mixes for your talent and for yourself. That can, you know, you don't have to have a separate little box doing your headphone amplification. Actually, this box is what we need, what Twirt needs on the road. Plus, it has an on-air Tally warning light relay output, and that's something that you won't find on guitar store mixing consoles. So this is really a professional little console, and I would encourage you to check it out. It's great for remotes. It's great to have one at the transmitter site if you have to go on from there. And as I mentioned, it's great for our broadcasting from home period of time that we're in right now. And who knows, we might be in it again someday. So check it out. The Broadcast Tools ProMix 4. And where do you get it? Well, you get it from Broadcasters General Store at bgs.cc. Or, you know, they just work so well on the phone. They're set up for that. Friendly voices and great service at 352-622-7700. 352-622-7700. Check them out. Thanks to Broadcaster General Store and Broadcast Tools for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. Encourage you to patronize them. Check them out if you would. All right. Bill Harlan is with us from ERI. And Bill, we should get right back into the pictures and videos. But you know what? Before we get to the Empire State Building pictures, I'm wondering if Suncast can change gears quickly and get that video ready. Bill, you haven't seen this, I don't think, but I've got about 1 minute of video here that was a drone climb up a tower that shows several ERI antennas, different ones, and maybe you can tell us about that. Suncast says he's ready, so let's see it. Let's see, right there, those are not ERI antennas right there. They must be coming up next. I think that's a backup antenna for somebody. This is yeah, Bill?
Actually, I think those are 100A. That's a 4-bay 100A, oh. And then this is...
there's a 4-bay. With radomes.
Yeah, that's 4-bay SHPX. That one had, particular one had white radomes.
And then here is a big antenna. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 bays. It's 12 bays. It's 12 bay antenna.
12 bay center fed rototiller.
Yep. Then here's a 1-bay.
And a single bay LPX.
And now I'm going to see if Suncast can stop this video at the end before it fades to black. But this is an 8-bay SPHX, I suppose.
Yep, right there. Black radomes, and there you can see just sticking up above there that's the shorting stub. That's a quarter wave shorting stub that grounds the inner to the outer. So
that's just above the highest bay there. Yeah.
Yes.
And then the lightning dissipators. What do you call those? What's your branding on those?
We just call them lightning spurs.
Oh, lightning spurs. Okay, lightning spurs. Yeah. And this tower, I'll tell you, is on the south side of Nashville. It's actually just barely into Williamson County in Brentwood, Tennessee. You're looking pretty much to the south in this drone shot. The sun is setting over to the right in the west, and you're looking out over the Brentwood, Tennessee area. But there's a bunch of Nashville FMs on this tower. I think that's a beautiful, beautiful tower. So, yeah. All right, Suncast, we got some pictures ready. The next ones in the series, and Bill's going to tell us about these. Oh my goodness, what are we looking at, Bill?
Oh, this is the auxiliary antenna for the Empire State Building. It's a 3-bay, and what's probably the coolest thing about this is we all hear about full wave and half waves bay to bay spacing. This particular antenna has what we call N-1/N spacing. So it's 3 bays.
What?
Yes, okay. 0.66 wavelength. And the benefit of that is this is right above the dome on the Empire State Building. And the problem is the problem with the Alfred antenna, which is around the rings on the dome, is that that you can't operate on it and have the observation deck open. And so the benefit of reducing from full wave spacing is when you get to N-1/N, or 0.66 in the case of this 3-bay, you massively reduce the amount of downward radiation. And so this antenna can have all 19 of the FM stations on the Empire State Building operating into this antenna at the same time, and you can still have the observation deck open. And what's going on? Yes. And what's going on here is, as you notice, unlike most of our panel antennas where we have a mesh screen reflector behind them, these are it's a solid steel reflector. And that's because they're welded around the outside of the tower so that climbers can crawl through the aperture with the antenna operating. And then this ice shield above it is actually also designed as an RF shield. So everybody can be running. Everybody can be running at full power. And you can come out of the tower after crawling through the inside of the auxiliary FM antenna and come out on that ice shield. And everybody can be running. And you can just stand there. And it's still below occupational radiation levels. And this is part of the acceptance testing was we measured that before we put the antenna in, because obviously fixing it after you put it up is a lot more expensive.
I believe Chris Tobin has been up there on a play date and swung from those. Chris, you've seen this antenna, haven't you?
Yeah, I've seen the antenna, the original, the primary one also, the old Alfred antenna system. I've been up on that, the dome out on the catwalk on many occasions, yes. It is a sight to behold. I mean, it's a work of art, the antenna design and the latest installation. It's pretty wild. I mean, it's even more interesting if you like RF, the black magic of it. You read the history of the Alfred antenna, the elliptical pattern and the 45-degree angle that the little dipoles are at. It's pretty cool. And the original Alfred, I think, started in Philadelphia, if memory serves me right. New York, I think, was second. But the best part was I didn't realize until years after working in the building, up on in the observation deck 102, when you look through the portholes, or the windows now, I think they're rectangular windows, and you look down, you could see the dipoles at an angle. I had no idea that RFR at the time, the amount of RF that was happening in that room as a kid when I was going up there for observation purposes. Years later to find out, we replaced the glass with a certain type of RF deficiency built into it for a reason.
Yeah.
It was fascinating. And then it's just like it became the broadband antenna after the new master antenna went in, the ERI. So when that went on the air, when that would go on, it was very limited because of its inability to maintain RF away from the observation deck.
I guess, Bill, you said 19 stations can operate into that standby antenna at the same time, or the aux antenna. Are those 19 stations using the same combining system as they are for the main, or is it a separate combining system?
It's a separate combining system. It's a fully redundant auxiliary system. And everyone, the system is rated for minus 10 dBc HD. And it's actually a very unusual feed system. The antenna is fed with, it has two inputs, a right-hand CP input and a left-hand CP input. And there are actually two constant impedance combiners. One has 10 stations in it and the other has 9, and they each feed a transmission line. So when all 19 are on, 10 have right-hand CP and 9 have left-hand CP.
Goodness gracious. And CP stands for circular polarization, right?
That's correct.
Okay. We have another picture of the same antenna, the Suncast. If you could toss that up, we'll take a look at this other picture that Bill's provided. Is this the same antenna?
That's the same antenna. This is just before we put the ice shield on it to measure that. This is the acceptance testing. That's on the first turntable, and that was the acceptance testing to demonstrate the azimuth pattern complying with specifications.
Now, if I'm looking closely at this, and maybe Suncast can zoom in a little bit more, I'm seeing on each cogwheel, if you will, each four-prong thing there, I'm seeing two of them. There's like two cogwheels. What's the smaller one, and what's the larger one for there?
The larger one's actually the radiating element, and the smaller one is a parasitic dome, which actually improves bandwidth.
Improves bandwidth. Okay. Wow. Wow. And you call this a three-bay antenna? Actually, there are 12 of those cogwheels, on four different sides, making up, it takes four of them to make one bay level, right?
Right. And when you have a 6 foot, 6 inch face like that, four around gives very good pattern circularity.
I can imagine. I can imagine. Wow, man, and we are running low on time. Bill, let's take a look at the next picture. And this is an antenna in an orientation you typically don't see an antenna on this next picture. What are we looking at here?
This is actually an 8-bay axiom. The axiom uses rototiller element, but it has a special feed system. So this can cover 18 megahertz of the FM band. It was really intended to be a lower cost master FM antenna. In fact, we just put a 16-bay version of this up on West Tiger 2 to replace the antenna that burned up a couple of years ago. These are half-wave spaced elements. They're 60 inches apart, and it uses a three-stage feed system, and the element orientation, the way they're fed, and the way the feed system works is how we achieve the bandwidth.
It looks like the bays, well, not exactly alternate. Some look like they're different orientations of the active part of the element there.
Yes.
Am I seeing that right?
They're half-wave spaced, so some of the elements are flipped to keep everything in place.
Gotcha. Okay. But you said the secret to this, or the key to its being able to be broadbanded, is this three-level feed system. I'm not sure what you call it.
You have a three-level feed system, and basically you have four-bay elements, which are made up of two end-fed two-bay pairs. And a pair of them are combined.
Okay. Wow, that is fascinating. that took some math and some calculation to make that work, didn't it?
Yes, we've got it set up that way. It's in final tuning, so that's why it's laying on its side.
Speaking of tuning, between bays, if you mentioned a number to me that you said was kind of a magic number in terms of spacing, and that was 0.926. What's special about that number?
Well, if you look at 0.9 or 0.926 spacing, actually the gain, the way we calculate gain is the gain itself is actually slightly higher than it is with full wave spacing. But the real benefit of it is you maintain the same level of gain, but you substantially reduce the downward and upward radiation.
For those who don't know, what is the benefit of reducing downward radiation? And we mean almost straight downward toward the transmitter building, and straight upward radiation. What's the benefit of reducing that?
Well, one, you get to put that energy where somebody might be able to hear it. But more importantly, if you're on the roof of a building, or I'm from the Pacific Northwest, so my idea of a 1,000-foot tower is a 150-foot tower on top of a 850-foot mountain above your listening area. So when you have short towers or you're on a building rooftop, then downward radiation is a big deal.
And that's a bit of a foreign idea to people in flat land like me. We have tall towers here, so downward radiation is not a human exposure problem. But hey, if you can put more power out to the people instead of down at the transmitter building, that sounds like a good idea. Suncast, what's the next picture we've got here? Ooh, that looks complicated.
Oh, yeah, well, no, it's not that complicated. That's it's deceptive, but that's a cogwheel antenna that's on two Beasley stations in Tampa. That's on top of a 550-foot tower. The 4-bay rototiller, or that's actually a 6-bay half-wave spaced rototiller, is an aux antenna. You see the transition platform right above that. This tower is in a rather dense part of in terms of buildings and commercial properties and residential in Tampa. And so it's got very short guying. And so this little 550-foot tower is actually face guide. So you've got those guy wires off not very far from, I think it's 35 or 40% guide.
Oh, wow. That is short guide. My goodness.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. Okay. And so we're running short on time. Let's see what the next picture is we have this picture. All right. And this one, what's this?
Yeah, this is on Lookout Mountain. This is a directional panel antenna owned by iHeart. That's actually a little self-supporting tower that we manufactured to support that. It's directional because, of course, you're on Lookout Mountain. So on the backside, there really isn't any population. And, of course, you got the quiet zone north Boulder that you have to protect. So I believe there's five or six facilities that share this antenna.
So if we could buzz to our next picture, I just want to get a little bit of an explanation from you, Bill. I mentioned earlier in the show about if you understand a ring stub antenna, it'll help you understand how transmission is occurring. So maybe you could explain the parts of this and what's actually occurring. And I noticed that the feed point is back in the saddle, if you will, back in the mounting part of this and yeah. Not stuck out on the bay itself. How's this work?
Yeah. No, it's you've got a ballon there with that, and there's an insulator on the end of it, and there's a strap that drives one half of that ring stub, and essentially the round part is the horizontally polarized component, and the little stub that sticks up creates the vertical component. This is really an update of the cycloid antenna, which was ERI's first circularly polarized antenna. They're inexpensive. They're generally shunt fed. So you've got pretty narrow bandwidth. They're definitely a single channel antenna, but as long as you kept the number of bays in minimized, they were very easy to tune and very inexpensive. We updated this 8 or 9 years ago. We used to make it out of brass and copper. Copper prices got way out of hand a few years ago, as you'll remember. So we converted this to aluminum, and most of them we ship overseas.
Gotcha. And we have one more picture, and it's a diagram. A lot of lower power stations would be using this, and maybe you could tell me. And there's other brands of antennas that look a lot like this. What's going on? How does this work?
This is a classic shunt fed, externally driven, bent dipole. You've got two, half wave dipoles that, the feed point is that insulator in the center and the two arms mm-hmm. that hook to it. This is a 100A series antenna. They come to you if they're not directionalized, they come in a pizza box and the instructions tell you how to set the arms to frequency. So, if you're on a translator and you get kicked off your channel, you can retune this one to yourself.
Wow. All right. Whew. Bill, I wish we had 2 hours. This is fascinating. And I think we could probably talk all day because we've covered like this much of what ERI does. That's just amazing.
Well, you need to come here and do a remote.
I think that'd be a lot of fun. You're not a very far drive for me. I think you're under a 3 hour drive for me to get up there. Yeah. So how far are you guys from Evansville?
Oh, we are. This is, I call it the Chandler Boonville Evansville Metroplex. Oh.
Okay. Okay. That's not terribly far at all. Chris. Okay. Bill, I'm going to give you a little fair warning right now. And I'm sorry I didn't give you proper fair warning before.
Oh, no.
After our this is the sneaky thing we do to keep our viewers and listeners through the final break, and that is we're gonna have a tip of the week, and Bill, it can be whatever you want that's going to be helpful for engineers in our audience to either maintain, select, whatever. What would be helpful for them to walk away with information from Bill Harlan and ERI? It's our tip of the week. It'll be coming up next. Chris, before we break, any final question for Bill?
Let's see. Yeah, the one question I have, which people always ask, and I've always over the years have heard this, is do you tune the antenna on frequency or slightly off for icing purposes in like northern parts of the country?
In general, we will tune the antenna to be about 200 kilohertz high if it doesn't have radomes. If it does have radomes, we tune it right on channel.
Okay, good. I had an experience with a consultant years ago about that. It was great. His name was Dean Sargent. I think that's right. Right, RCA Labs.
and Chris, the upshot of that is if your antenna ices up, then your stereo image just moves a little bit from left to right. That's all it really does.
Exactly.
All right, Bill.
I'll explain during the tip of the week. I'll explain why I asked the question.
Okay. Bill is going to be back with a tip of the week in just a minute. And hey, I got to get a prop here. Oh, my goodness. On This Week in Radio Tech, oftentimes Chris uses his. I've been in the office so much with COVID, but we've been talking about the Max Connect 4G LTE wireless modem that gives you prioritized data, priorities over everybody else. And look what came in the mail late last week. It's a different modem. Now, see, I've been telling you that it doesn't depend on the brand. This is a Cradlepoint, right? We've been using this for a while. This one is a PepWave, and it's got a couple interesting benefits and advantages. Chris, I believe you should be getting yours pretty soon too. Either that or your SIM cards.
I got the SIM card for the current one, I guess. Okay.
Well, I think they shipped me this one so that I can write up a little piece on how to do a port forward, because this is being used with some Telos Omnia gear, and somebody thought they had a problem with the port forwarding. They wanted me to write up a piece on, step-by-step how to do a port forward in this. So I haven't written it yet, but I'll be doing that soon. But this is a PepWave brand 4G LTE modem. It really is so much like this one. I'm sure the UI inside is different, but it's the same features that you get from Max Connect Wireless. Fixed IP address. I better cover that up. A fixed IP address. And so you just turn this thing on, and this one also has two different SIM cards that you can use with it. But you turn it on, you get your fixed IP address, and you can do a port forward if you need to. You can use any other means to get into your stuff, a stun or turn server, if you've got a VoIP phone or something like that. But if you need to push audio to a transmitter site on an emergency basis, you can do it with this reliable service and reliable data, because you're getting prioritized data, prioritized over everybody else. The best the cell tower will do, you get it. And Chris Tobin has experienced this numerous times himself with Sam doing some live remote broadcasts. We've done a number of broadcasts here on This Week in Radio Tech. And hey, the SBE has done a whole national meeting in Las Vegas with using Max Connect Wireless. So check it out on the web. It's Max, spelled funny, maxconnectwireless.com. And I think they got Max Connect now. You can just go to Max Connect and drop the word wireless if you want to and get to the same place. Check it out because literally hundreds of radio stations are using these for live remotes, for access to transmitter sites that otherwise don't have data, and for backup emergency STL. Thanks a lot, Max Connect Wireless, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech, a real help to the broadcast engineers that are listening. All right, tip of the week here. We've got just about a minute. Bill, what do you want to leave our listeners with?
The most important thing to do is once a year have somebody climb your tower and make sure all the hardware is where it needs to be and all the pieces of your antenna are there.
That will save you money. And I know from personal experience, because I've had a couple of disasters on towers that didn't get climbed, that disasters could have been averted. So good advice, Bill. Thank you very much. Chris Tobin, did you have a piece of advice for us too?
Yeah, I was dovetail on what Bill talked about. You can visually inspect that. You should definitely do that without a doubt. Oh, what I also would recommend, and I've done it myself quite often, actually once a year, is sweep the antenna system, sweep the RF system from the output of the transmitter all the way up and through whatever else you're going through, whether it's combiners and everything else, and make sure you could use a VNA, a network analyzer, check your return losses, look for any anomalies that might occur, make sure the specs still meet the same as they were when the antenna was installed. And if you have an ERI product, you most likely will see the same thing, because I can tell you from early on in my career, Dean Sargent, the RCA Labs guy who was hired by FMX Group, was doing some experiments with us at our station. Single bay ERI rototiller comes out to the site, looks up, he goes, I know what you got. He puts some numbers on a piece of paper, does a nice sweep test, group delay and everything else with the transmitter, sweeping everything, comes back to me and says, here are my numbers, give me the napkin I gave you. Sure enough, they were within a half a dB. He says, if you need a product that works, just call Tom. He'll make sure the antenna will work every time. I don't even have to tell you how far off it is in frequency. That's why I asked about the question with the icing.
Yeah.
True. It was me. This is when I was like, just getting in and learning stuff about RF. This guy just walks up with this $40,000 HP and goes, okay, I don't need this. I know what you got. You're fine.
No, it's good.
Did you not? It was the wildest event. It was great.
But if there was a problem with some non-ERI element in the chain, then he would find it, right?
Yes. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. But I recommend, Bill's absolutely right. Inspect your antenna. There's nothing that beats visual inspection. End of story. Second, do the RF sweep. Look at it. You'd be surprised the things you discover. You didn't even realize a bullet may be having trouble, or there's a few things that could happen that you may not see because the jacket may be covering it.
And we've also learned that infrared inspection can be helpful too, but that's, you got to know what you're doing to do that effectively. We got to go. I wish we had more time. We got to go now. Bill Harlan, thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute delight to have you here.
Thank you.
All right. Absolutely. I want to thank Chris Tobin for joining us as well. And I want to thank Suncast, our producer. Great job with all the graphics and the video. Thank you so much. And thanks also to Andrew Zarian, the founder of GFQ Network, where you'll find lots of other podcasts as well. We got to go. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.